Hello and welcome to What Else Do You Do? I'm your host, Masao. I'm an indie producer working in the studio Cut to Bits. And today our guest is Rami Ismail. Please introduce yourself.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Rami Ismail, independent developer. I've been making video games for 12 years professionally, and since I was six as a hobby. I spent most of my days, well, pre-COVID anyway, I spent most of my days traveling the world, working with independent developers everywhere, trying to make sure that everybody around the world has equal chances in our industry, no matter where they're born, what language they speak, you know, their economical circumstances. I grew up Dutch-Egyptian, so to see my one culture thrive in the games industry and my other culture not so much, despite having very similar friends in both, just always felt like an injustice to me. So that's kind of my quest and my life, I guess.
I think it's really cool that you do that. There's so much inequity in this industry that it's really inspiring to see somebody out there trying to help out people who have less opportunity and infrastructure to allow them to make games.
It's been such a rewarding thing to do as well when you think about it. Like, I've had the privilege of meeting developers everywhere in such different circumstances, with such different backgrounds, with so many different cultures and histories and musics and foods and stories and mythologies. And I could not have wished for a better 20s. Like, I'm 33 now. Like, COVID sort of hit at the start of my 30s. And just having had the privilege of seeing the world everywhere.
Wait, you're only 33? I always thought you were older.
No, I'm 33. But that's the thing. I
mean, you've been around for so long.
The thing that makes it so interesting to me is that having seen so much of the world at this age and having my life be shaped by that is such a remarkable privilege, and it's such an interesting perspective. I know I'm very lucky. I just can't imagine being anywhere else. Growing up, I would have not dared to dream anything close to this. So it's been a remarkable decade for me.
But this podcast is called What Else Do You Do? So what else do you do?
Gosh, I do a lot of things. I really enjoy cooking. That's one thing that I love. I'm a avid Lego builder, because it's a thing that I can do where somebody else tells me what to do and then it turns out nice. And starting last year, I'm training to be a pilot, getting my private pilot's license, as it's called.
That's pretty unusual. I was just going to say, I don't know any other game developer who's a pilot, but that's not true. I actually worked with one. But how did you get into it? Did you know somebody who was a pilot, or did you always want to do it?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter one. Actually, it's really funny. You know, when I said I became a game developer as an amateur when I was six, the thing I wanted to be when I started to get into game development was a pilot. Because when I was a kid, we would have one flight a year, well, two flights, from the Netherlands to Egypt, from my family in the Netherlands to my family in Egypt, and then back. And I just remember thinking it was so cool for all of my life that you could get in a tube and then sit in a chair and then get out of the tube and then just be in a different world. People spoke a different language. Yeah. People had a different, like, it was suddenly hot and there was, like, dust and sand and, like, life was different. The Egyptians would be awake at night and the Dutch would be awake during the day, and like just everything changed. And the thing that made it happen was this tube from which you could see the clouds from above, which is just wild. And back in those days, kids could go and see the cockpit, right?
Yeah.
And then in the magic tube, you would be watching the world from above. Like, everything was so small and everything was so different, and you would see the clouds that you normally can only see from below. You'd see them from above and you'd realize that no matter what the weather is under the clouds, above the clouds, it's always sunny, right? It's always clear sky up there. So I wanted to be a pilot, but then I don't know who told me, but somebody told me that you need a perfect vision to be a pilot. And then 2 or 3 years later, it turned out I needed glasses. Like, I very desperately needed glasses. I was staring out of the car. We were driving to my grandmother, and I saw a little field of grass, and I thought it was a lake full of, like, algae. And my mom was just like, "What lake?" And I'm like, "The." And she's like, "That's not a lake. That's a field." I'm like, oh no. So we got my eyes tested, and I needed glasses, so that it just instantly stopped my belief that I could be a pilot. And by that time, I'd started like doing a little bit of programming on that computer, and I kind of fell in love with that. So my life just took that exit instead of the piloting exit. And it's kind of stayed a dream.
So is that actually true? Do you have to have perfect vision to be a pilot?
No, there's requirements, but the general requirement isn't perfect vision. You need good vision, but you can use assistive devices as long as, without assistive devices like glasses or lenses, you can still see well enough to operate basic instruments. So you basically need to be able to see, I think it's about 40 centimeters or like 22 inches or something away from your face. Yeah, there's a lot of medical testing involved, but none of it is like you cannot use assistive devices. That's not it. One thing they're very strict about here in the Netherlands is that you can't laser your eyes. If you laser your eyes, that is an automatic disqualification. You can get an exception for that, but they were starting to get worried that everybody who wanted to be a pilot would just get their eyes lasered. And since that is, you know, still a pretty intense surgical procedure, they kind of went like, okay, let's just make that a disqualification where you get an exception instead of the other way around. So I didn't do anything with aviation besides be in a plane to Egypt once a year and then back to the Netherlands. And then when I was 20, my girlfriend at that time bought me a training flight as a birthday gift. And I got to fly at the city that I had just moved to, Hilversum, which is where I still live. And I got like a little explanation of how airplanes actually work, you know, like the way the wings work and how they deflect air and like how that generates lift and all of those things. And then I got to go in an airplane with like an instructor next to me, and the instructor, she took off, and then we flew a bit, and then she said, okay, now you grab the controls and steer the airplane. And it was awesome. It was incredible. Like it's such a different feeling than you would expect. And then we went back and we landed, and I started looking into whether I could do flight class. And then, I was too poor. It's very expensive. I always grew up very poor. Like, we're talking about poor on like a Dutch scale, right? A Netherlands scale. It's not the equivalent of like poverty in countries where the division between rich and poor is much more extreme, like in the US or in like countries that are poor. But we weren't affluent. We couldn't afford luxuries like that. So I just kind of dropped the dream. Started a game studio, did really well for myself at Vlaambeer, which I started back then. And then I ran a game studio and I was traveling the world all the time to do the things that I do. So I didn't have time to become a pilot. And then actually the thing that sort of pushed me into it in the end was COVID happened, which put me in the Netherlands for an extended period of time. And I had a really bad breakup that was just broke my heart. And I just needed something. I needed to fulfill a dream. I needed something to chase, to not be sad. And I decided that, you know what, I'm going to try another training flight. And that's where it started.
So how many hours do you have to train before they let you fly a plane alone?
That's a very complicated question because it's not that straightforward.
Is there like a paper test that you have to pass or like a class you have to take before you go get on that first plane?
No, usually it's like a 30-minute. It's a 30-minute thing.
So what is the requirement to fly a plane alone?
You need to complete a few steps before you can actually fly alone. So you have to do something called dual, which is flights with an instructor. And you need to do about 10 hours of that. And then at the end of those 10 hours, a lot of flight schools will do something called a prof check, which is a proficiency check. Basically, they check whether you can do all the exercises right. And there's a whole bunch of exercises, takeoff, a cruise where you're just flying like straight and level, turns, climbs, descends, but also like a few more exciting exercises. So you need to do something called slow flight, where you slow the airplane down a lot, but still have to keep flying. And if you slow an airplane down far enough, you go into something called a stall, where effectively the airplane starts falling from the sky, and you kind of need to fix it You need to know how to fix it. And that's it's a really important exercise because, so in an airplane, you've got your flight controls, right? You can turn your yoke, your steering wheel left or right, but you can also pull it backwards or push it forwards. And if you pull it towards you, the airplane goes up. And if you push it away from you, the airplane goes down. So when you stall, your airplane starts falling. And a lot of people's initial reflex is then to pull on the steering wheel to get the airplane to go up. But in aviation, everything is an exchange. So if you want to climb, you're going to lose speed, right? And if you want, if you descend, you're going to gain speed. So you're always trading altitude for speed. So if you're stalling, it means you're going slow.
Okay, so what you want to do is fall a little bit and get some speed so you can go back up.
That's exactly it. And it's the full opposite of people's reflex. So people tend to pull on the yoke because they want to go back up because the airplane is falling.
And then you can just completely stall out.
Then they slow down even further, and then you can get into very, very dangerous situations. So they really drill that stall into you. Like, they make it so that when you feel the stall, your reflex has to be, without thinking, has to be to push the nose forward and gain a little bit of speed. So we've trained that a lot. And then besides that, there's also a whole bunch of procedural stuff. So, for example, you need to do your medical, which proved to me, finally, that you don't need to actually have perfect vision to fly. And it was the funniest thing. I went to this German old lady, and I'm in the Netherlands. So, you know, Germany is the next country over. But she'd been in the Netherlands for like 40 years. She's married to a guy that runs another flight school. And she has that German tendency to like rate everything.
I wasn't aware that was a German stereotype.
From the Netherlands, that's definitely sort of like they're a lot more about saying things are like Dutch people usually go like, okay. Well, Germans will say things in terms of like excellent or terrible, or like they have a lot more granularity in how they describe things. Okay. And she was great. She would go check things. So she would check like everything. Honestly, it was the first full medical checkup I've had in ever, I think. But like they checked everything from like my heart rate, my vision, my hearing. They checked urine, heart, they checked blood, they checked everything. And at every test, she would go like, excellent, excellent. Yeah, that's wonderful. That's very good, very good, very good. And then, you know, my eyes, she's like, well, you have glasses, so we couldn't expect it to be excellent. But, you know, given your glasses, this is very good, very good. And then she got to my weight and she's like, ooh, that's not good. Like, I know, lady, it's been COVID. Like, please. You don't have to rub it in. I have a belly. I know. Come on. But yeah, your weight is kind of relevant for flying, obviously. So,
oh, because planes have a specific payload.
No one human is going to be too heavy for a Cessna 172, which is the plane I fly. But
yeah,
it might limit the kind of passengers I can take. So I got roasted.
You're also very tall.
I'm 2 meters, so I'm...
Sir, you're a big guy.
I'm in like the 110-ish range in kilograms, which it's not terrible, but it's also not like...
I mean, you're 2 meters. That's not crazy.
I know. That's what I keep telling myself. But the doctor was very clear on that it wasn't great. So I got my medical. And then the other thing is you can't actually use a VHF radio, which is the type of radio we use to talk to the tower, unless you're licensed for use for that VHF radio. So you need a certificate.
That makes sense.
For your first solo, you don't need it because you're flying on your instructor's license, effectively. But before you complete flight class, you need to have that registration. So a lot of things are happening at once now. I just did my prof check, which means I'm basically ready to fly alone. And it's really terrifying. It's really scary. It's also really exciting. I don't know.
What is it like being up there in a Cessna? Because you're so much lighter than a commercial flight. You're much more affected by things like wind, right?
Yeah. And at the same time, you're also not, right? Like, you have to imagine the surface area of one of those Boeings is enormous. So the amount of wind that blows into them is pretty high. But they have such powerful turbines that it kind of offsets, right? And they have such powerful controls that it kind of offsets. Well, Cessna, yeah, it's a little bit more of a plaything.
Well, and there's also the concept of inertia, right? Like, right. The heavier you are, you're less affected by.
I mean, this is also a thing. I recently did my first landing on a paved runway, right? So the airfield I fly out of is it's called Echo Hotel Hotel Victor, EHHV, Hilversum, and it's an airfield, which means it's a grass field. There's no pavement. You just land on a strip of grass. And like back in the days, before aviation structuralized the way it is now, an airfield would literally just be a windsock in the ground in an open field. And you would see which way the wind was coming from, and then you would fly into the wind and just land. There was no runway, no direction. You just pick a direction and put the airplane on the ground.
I guess that makes sense. It's easier to land in the wind because it would slow you down.
Yeah, it's not. So it's a little more complicated than that, but it's the same concept. The way an airplane flies is there is an amount of air going over the wing. And the more air is going over the wing, the easier you fly, right? So for landing on a Cessna, you want to come in at 65 knots, which is a certain airspeed. And that's the speed of the air going over the wing. Now, if you're flying and you want to touch the ground, the moment you touch the ground, you switch from airspeed to what is ground speed. It's your speed over the ground. So if you're flying a Cessna at 100 knots an hour, and you've got 20 knots coming from the front, then over the ground, you're only going 80 knots.
Oh, so it's the differential that makes it easier.
If you have the wind coming from the front and you're flying at 65 and you've got 15 knots from the front, then you're hitting the ground at only 50 knots, which is slower, which means that your landing is going to be easier. But it's also, you know, you have to be careful with that, because if that wind suddenly drops and you're flying 65, now you're flying 50, which is dangerously close to a stall speed, which means you drop out of the sky. So there's all these like little variables that you're playing with, but as long as the wind is relatively consistent and coming from the front, that's much easier to land, because your airspeed will be higher compared to your ground speed, which means you'll land at a slower speed, which is kind of nice. The wind from behind is terrifying.
Yeah, because essentially you speed up when you hit the ground.
Exactly. So that's not a great feeling. We did an exercise a while back where I was in the Cessna over a little town, and we had pretty hard wind coming from the front, like 20 knots or something. And the instructor said, like, okay, let's fly a bit slow. So we flew a bit slow, and we were going like 60, 70 knots, somewhere 60, 70 knots. And I looked down, and it was literally like the ground was barely moving under me. Even though I had an airspeed of like 60, and I was like, whoa.
Oh, because of the headwind.
Because the headwind meant that I was going 60 over in air relative to the air, but on the ground, I was only going like 40 something.
It's like you're swimming in a current pool.
Right. Yeah, it's a little bit like that. So it's really interesting just the way. And it's weird because it turns into a feeling so fast. You think that all this aviation stuff is a lot of like instruments and like reading all the little gauges and all that. But the first thing they teach you is to stop looking at those. The first thing they teach you is to look outside, because in VFR flight, which is visual flight, which is the type of flight I do, nobody is separating you from other traffic per se. And you don't want to hit another airplane. That's bad. So, you know, they teach you look outside, like just keep looking outside. And if you want to do a turn, you can initiate the turn and then use your instruments to figure out whether you're banking the right amount of degrees. But then as soon as you have that turn, they tell you, look outside, see how the cockpit, you know, the sort of the line of your cockpit is cutting the horizon. Put that sight picture is what they call it. Put that sight picture in your mind and then hold that sight picture and you will continue turning exactly at the angle you want. Like stop looking inside, like look outside, see how your engine block is cutting the horizon. Put that in your mind and then start just, you know, turning your head. Look if somebody is ahead in your turn. Look if somebody is nearby. Check whether the side picture is still the same. Look outside, scan around, check the side picture, look outside, check your instrument, check your side picture. And so they're really teaching you to not do the thing that everybody imagines with airplanes. Look at all the little like gizmos and gadgets. And it's very much a feeling thing, which is really, really wonderful. I spend enough time, you know, during my day looking at gizmos and gadgets and like numbers going up and down. I really like that this is more of a feeling thing right now.
Well, let's bring this back to game development. What do you think you get out of flying that you don't out of game development?
Well, I go outside. That's nice.
Yeah, especially nowadays.
Yeah, right. I think you know, one of the things that I love about game development is that it gives you incredible freedom to just kind of sort of like decide how you want things to be. Right? You're kind of in control of every part of the whole thing, because computers don't have any preconceived notions. They're actually they're not that smart, right? They're just really fast at calculations, but at heart, computers are not very smart.
They just follow instructions.
Yeah, they just do what you tell them. So we can kind of create anything, right? We create gravity, we create friction, we create what way the character can move and interact. And I think one thing that feels very nice about flying is that it's this weird choreography with nature. It's this dance between technology and nature, where computers are just fully computers, right? They're just full technology. And it's this really interesting dance. I tried to put this into words to a friend lately, and I said, the thing about taking off is it feels very destructive. It's very powerful, right? You're basically turning on this engine and you're cranking it to full power, and then you literally overcome nature as you know it as a human body. We can overcome gravity shortly by jumping, but we can't overcome gravity. We're not built to do that. And then you're in an airplane and you just push this thing forward, and now this machine just like starts going, and it overcomes nature. And then flying straight and level is balancing out the force of that machine exactly against the force of nature, right? You want zero. You want not up, not down, just straight
because
forward.
You want to coast, yeah.
You want to go straight. So you have to balance out your machine exactly against this eternal force on our planet, right? That will be there and is going to be there for as long as the planet is around. But then landing is even more beautiful. Landing is my favorite part because it's sort of like a surrender back to the ground. Right, a surrender back to gravity. You balance out the machine and nature until you force the machine to lose against nature and get back to the ground. And there's a really odd sense of beauty in that entire dance, in that you go up into the sky, and in the sky everything is different, right? Every problem seems smaller because everything is smaller. You have the clouds around you, you have the sky around you. It makes me feel like, you know, when I was a kid, watching from those big airplanes, watching the world pass under me. But now it's me. But it's not just me. It's not like on a computer, where if I want something, all that's stopping me from achieving it is whether I can program it. Right? Here in the air, everything is a dance. It's a negotiation with forces so much bigger than me. And it's really satisfying. It feels interesting.
That is really cool because, you know, gravity isn't something we typically can counter.
Flying is still temporarily. My instructor always reminds me, you know, going up there is optional. Getting back down is obligatory. Like, they have a lot of very morbid sayings in flying.
I mean, it makes sense. It's serious business and people do die.
That's one thing that I've gotten a lot of respect for is sort of like the processes of flight. So before you fly, there's like a 10-minute checklist, just like a book with rules, and you have to follow those step by step. And pretty much every single thing on that list is there because somebody died doing it wrong. Yeah. Right? Because one of my favorite was you have to, before you fly, you have this little cup with a little pokey thing at the top, and there's a little hole at the bottom of your wing for your Cessna. And you basically poke the pointy thing in the wing, in this little hole, and then a bunch of fuel comes out. And then you have a bunch of fuel from the airplane in the cup, right? And then you have to hold it up against something white, which usually your wing is going to be white, to see whether it's not transparent. And you have to check whether the surface of the fluid is kind of hollow instead of flat. Because water is transparent.
Oh, it's true.
And flat.
Water chance, yeah, and also will...
Okay, that makes sense, because fuel has color and the surface tension works differently because fuel is nonpolar.
Right. So we need to check that because the fuel caps on the Cessna are at the top of the wing. So if somebody forgot to close that properly and it rained overnight, the tanks are going to be full with water, which is really bad for, you know, combustion engines.
You don't say.
Yeah. So we need to check whether the thing in our wing is actually fuel, presumably because somebody went like, oh, my tanks are full. Great, let's fly. And then like had a really bad time flying.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating that pretty much everything on there, you just go like, why do we do this? And it's like, well, because if this doesn't work right, then you're going to be in a lot of trouble and potentially die. And it's like, oh, did that happen? And they're like, well, it's a checklist. So yeah,
probably,
presumably, yes.
Yeah.
Well, at least with planes, you know that even if your engine stops, you can still glide.
One of the first times I flew, there was a safety briefing, and our school does all sorts of stuff. They do parachutes and gyrocopters and helicopters and airplanes and gliders and I don't know what. And there was just sort of like a general, like, here's how you deal with emergencies, right? And they went through every category. And for gliders and airplanes, it was, you know, like, do this, do that, grab your checkbook, check that, see if this still works, do that, blah, 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 this and that. And then for parachutes, it was like, okay, do this. If you have a reserve chute, do that. Like, you know, aim for that. Like, do this. And then they got to copters, and it just basically went like, okay, well, if there is some sort of failure, then, you know, do this, do that, do that. If your engine is just out, you know, like, good luck. And that was it. That was basically the safety. Like, there was nothing beyond that, because apparently you can't do much with a helicopter. It just drops.
Immediate, too. No, like, there's no coasting.
There's a little bit of coasting that you can generate by pointing it into air. But effectively, the rotor at the top is the same principle as a wing, but instead of making the wing go through, making the air go over the wing, they make the wing go through the air.
Yeah.
That's why it spins. So it's just four big wings being forced to spin through the air in such a way that you generate lift. If that thing stopped, there's a thing called the Jesus bolt on a helicopter. I'd never heard of it. It's apparently a bolt that attaches the rotor system to the air, to the helicopter body. If that bolt fails, all you have left to do is basically pray to Jesus.
Because you just lost your rotor.
You lost your rotor. And I'm just like, they actually call it that. And they're like, yep, that's 100% what it's called. No kidding. That's what it's called. And I'm like, I'm going to keep it to the thing with the wings. Like, I've done all sorts of exercises related to, like, engine outs. And it's like, okay, well, you know, engine is out. We're at 3,000 feet. So you have, like, you know, quite a bit of time. Take your time. Pick a place. You know, do optimal glide slope. Like, keep this angle. Keep the speed up. Watch your speed. You can make some turns. Where do you want to go? And just having a chat. Just like, oh, the engine is no longer working. Okay, well, how about over there? Yeah, no, take a look. Like, look carefully. It's not like the instructor is like, no, you got to do it now. The instructor is like, no, you picked that point. Why did you pick that point? And it's like, well, you know, like, it looks open. He's like, where's the wind coming from? Like, I don't know. He's like, well, look at the world. Is there smoke? Are the trees moving? Where's the wind coming from? And I'm like, west, I guess? Right. So let's find a field that is open in that direction, because we're going to want to land into the wind, preferably. And we're just having this casual chat after he shut down the engine in the airplane, effectively put it to idle. There's no force being generated. And we're just having a casual chat about, like, is that a good spot? No, try again.
Yeah.
They're so chill about it. Yeah, I love that.
I guess you do know that you can turn it back on, so I guess that helps.
Right. Right. You do pre-checks, actually. Before you lower your engine output, you check whether all the things that you need to make it go faster again are working. So you check your oil pressure, you check your heating, your carburetor heating, you check all these different things, and then you slow down the engine. But I think that's one of the things that I really love about aviation so far, is I've learned a lot about me in the process of becoming a pilot, right? There was this one exercise that I was doing where I was flying a circuit, which is basically sort of a racetrack in the air that starts and ends at the runway. And it's always at a set altitude, and it's basically there to make sure that we don't hit each other in the air. So it's this sort of predictable way of flying around airfields if you want to land there. So that everybody kind of knows at what altitude everybody is. And you can call each other and say, like, hey, I'm on the base leg, which is the final turn before pointing at the runway. or I'm downwind, which is parallel to the runway. So you can just call that on the radio and say like, hey, I'm downwind. And then everybody else knows like, oh, got to watch for a plane there. Right. And we already know the altitude. So it really makes communication easy and it makes everything a little predictable. And there was a lot of wind that day. So I took the turn from downwind to base, which is basically I'm going from parallel to the runway in the opposite direction to perpendicular to the runway. So there's one more turn before I'm pointed at the runway. And I just had a lot of wind in the back. So after I took that turn, I basically overshot the runway to my left, right? I had the runway to my left and I just shot past it. And I just took a steep turn to point back at the runway. And my instructor basically yanked the yoke back to the right. And it's like, no. Like, what? He's like, you're flying slow. You can't take a steep turn right now because it'll increase the speed at which your airplane stalls. So you're risking dropping us out of the sky for what? I'm like, I want to line up with the runway. He's like, no, you made a mistake. And you try to fix it immediately. Instead, when you make a mistake, try to fix it smartly.
So you take another lap.
Yeah, effectively, you go around. You just do it again, which is far safer trying to fix it immediately. But your human sort of, you want to fix everything immediately. You say something wrong. You don't, a lot of people, when they make a mistake in a sentence, they don't restart the sentence. They don't take a second to think. They just go back two words and then try again, right? Yeah. In an airplane, that can be fatal. So sort of like this process of thinking about like, how do I approach mistakes in real life actually was really confrontational, because I am like that. I make a mistake. I want to fix it, right? Yeah. And I'd rather fix it now than in 10 minutes, right? And it's the same thing I get in trouble with on Twitter. If I say something that is a poor tweet, then I immediately try to fix it instead of thinking, okay, no. Let's go over what went wrong here and let's think about that, right? And it has calmed me down a lot, just the aviation training, to just be like, okay, you know what? This isn't going great. What options do I have, right? Your problem solving and sort of your emotional responses to things, you have to understand them. Part of my training is also like, for example, how a human body reacts to fear or shock. That's part of training, because you need to know that. Because if your propeller shoots off your airplane, you're going to be terrified. You're going to be shocked. And if you make mistakes in that area of time, it's going to make things worse. So you have to understand, okay, I'm feeling shocked right now. I'm feeling fear right now. Let's take a moment. They teach you about like this effect where you basically immediately after shock, your brain will immediately shoot to waste to solve it. And then you should suppress that, right? It's just very fascinating. It's very fun. I'm not used to not being good at things I do. Sounds kind of arrogant, I guess, but like, I'm a game developer. I've been doing that since I was 6. I'm a public speaker. I've been doing that for 15 years. Like, the things that I do that I love, I tend to be quite good at. So this thing, I'm learning. I'm like sweating, trying to learn my exams and like, you know, theory courses. And like, I'm doing radio training right now and I have to learn, like, you know, got to say like, okay, have some radio, Papa Hotel Whiskey Mike Alpha, radio check on frequency 121.095. And the instructor will go, no, you have to say niner. You have to say niner because nine is no in German and it might be confusing. So we've agreed that the number nine is pronounced as niner. And I'm like, oh, crap. Okay. 121.095. And they're like, okay, that's good. Is it like that sense of like just having to catch up with people that are really good at what they do? It's really fun.
Let me flip that question over. How do you think your interest in aviation has impacted you as a game developer?
Well, I mean, obviously, the main thing I'm learning is actually something that I find very, very sorely missing in game development, which is the idea of generational knowledge, right? And it's something that I've always wanted more of in the games industry, as this sort of soft feeling. And I just kind of felt like, why are we having the same discussion every 10 years, right? Because I would start noticing a discussion coming back.
It's a new set of people.
It's a new set of people. But the same is true for aviation, is somehow they manage to do it, right?
Yeah.
And we don't. And I find that fascinating. And I've been trying to push for this sort of thing forever, right? Like I set up Game Dev World. I try to go around the world helping people, and I try to help the people that will then help people, because if I help people that will help people, then the people they help will have been helped and will be more likely to help. Cycle thing. But it's kind of how I found that the world works, right? If you help helpful people, they will create more helpful people. But there has to be better ways of doing this. You know, I don't know. I think it's interesting. The one thing I've been thinking about is what if my path had been the opposite, right? What if nobody had told me that you can't fly with glasses, and I would have become a pilot, and I would be flying around now, maybe really big airplanes, right? And then I would assume that game development would be my hobby, right? That I would be thinking about these games that I would want to make while flying an airplane. I don't know. For some reason, I feel very thankful that it happened this way, that my job is game development, that I wake up and I make video games, and then 2-3 times a week, I get to be really excited about loading up my flight bag and getting the knee path thingy, which is like a little table that you like Velcro around your leg because there's no place to write on an airplane. So they have these portable tables that go around your upper leg. It's brilliant. I want That's them cool. everywhere. I love it. It's the greatest invention in the history of mankind. But yeah, like I'm learning all sorts of stuff about like weather, meteorology. Like I look outside at the weather right now and I'm like, oh, you know, instead of like, it's cloudy, I'm like, it's, you know, it's probably some low pressure environment. Might be an inversion up there. I don't know. What's the dew point today? And it's just like the way aviation has changed how I look at the world. It feels like such a treat. Well, I feel like the way game development would have changed how I looked at the world would actually be far more limited, which is really surprising because I always thought that the game development has really shaped how I look at the world, but I think my games are shaped by how I look at the world. Not the other way around. I think games sometimes shape how I look at the world, but game development hasn't done much to change how I think about things, I think. And it might just be because it's invisible to me. I've been doing this since I was 6, right? So maybe it went so gradual that I haven't noticed. But like games,
it's like breathing.
Yeah, it's a creative field. I've always been a creative. It's a technological field. I've always looked at the world in systems to the point of like, I argued that clocks were dumb when I was like 7, because I thought that it was ridiculous that they went to 12. You know, like that it. A lot of who I am, I think, just fits game development really well. So I don't think game development changed a lot about me. The opportunities it has given me have changed a lot about me. But game development itself kind of hasn't. Well, aviation right now is really changing how I look at the world. And it feels like a good slap across the face, I guess. It feels like being woken up. Right? It's like, oh, wow, there's other stuff on Earth. This is great. I think my life has been defined by one thing for a decade. People knew me as Rami from Flambeer, and now I just get to be Rami Ismail, like aviation enthusiast. I just like it. I've been this one thing that people have wanted me to be for a decade, and now there's just this thing that is mine, and I get to share it, and it's incredibly wonderful.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. This was a lovely conversation. I learned a lot. And this was a lot of fun.
It really was. Thanks so much for having me. I don't get to talk about this with a lot of people very much. So appreciate it.
Well, take care and have a good evening.
You too, man.
Thank you for listening. Thank you to Dave Wallace for providing the music. And thank you to Therese Lance for providing the logo. Bye.